Shrink Wrap Radio number 363, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity with Dr. Scott Haltzman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Scott Haltzman, and we'll be discussing issues surrounding infidelity. Scott Haltzman, MD, is a former Brown University assistant professor and one of the country's foremost experts on infidelity and marriage. He's the author of the best-selling books, The Secrets of Happily Married Men and The Secrets of Happily Married Women. Dr. Haltzman's opinions on relationship issues of the day are sought after by prominent national media outlets, including 2020, Nightline, The New York Times, and Time Magazine. Dr. Haltzman trained at Brown and Yale and lectures internationally. He's currently a staff psychiatrist at the David Lawrence Center in Naples, Florida. He's been married for 25 years. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Scott Haltzman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. We're going to be talking about infidelity today, and you say it's a pretty taboo subject. Do I have that right?
We don't talk about infidelity typically because it's considered to be a source of great shame and humiliation. What's really unfortunate about that is so many people are affected by it, and yet when it happens to an individual, that person doesn't realize how common it is and how there are resources and help out there for people.
Okay. Well, what are the statistics on infidelity? I don't know if you've got them at the top of your head or not, but you probably have some sense of
I have some sense, but I think that part of the reality is that we just don't know the statistics because people don't tell the truth about whether they're having affairs. The most common cited statistics are something at around, say, 25% of men, 18% of women. So maybe about 40% of relationships may be affected by infidelity. But certainly I've seen statistics that put it closer to 60 or 70% of relationships are affected. So in part, the issue, David, is how you define infidelity. So whether somebody that has an intense emotional relationship with another person but never had sex or somebody. Other people would define infidelity as simply looking at pornography. So part of the issue is definition, but I would say that a conservative estimate is that 40% of marriages have been affected by sexual infidelity at some point in their marriage.
Well, you raise definition. What's your definition?
Well, my definition is what it doesn't really matter in the sense that it matters what at least one member of a partnership will define as infidelity. Mm-hmm. That's a bit tongue in cheek. I think if you are having sexual relations with another person that's outside of the marriage, it's pretty clear that that's infidelity. But if you are in a what we call an open relationship, some type of mutually agreed upon arrangement where anybody can sleep with anybody, then even in those cases, that might not be considered infidelity. On the reverse end of it is somebody who's on the email frequently, getting text messages from a coworker, sharing stories, having private secret lunches with them, and not telling the partner. I think it would be legitimate if their partner felt that that was an affair. I think you could argue that, yes, that you have cheated on your spouse.
Okay. Now, your advice is based not only on your experience as a couples therapist, but you also created a website, I believe. Tell us a bit about that. What led you to create that website and how you've used it?
You can find my website at drscott.com. It actually originally it was called secretsofmarriedmen.com because the first book that I wrote was on how men can successfully negotiate marriage and have happy marriages. That was the area of my research, and really it was one of very few non-commercially oriented sites to help understand and research marriage. And at different times, for instance, my book on the secrets of happy families, actually I had a formal research tool where I interviewed up to 1,200 people and with multiple choice questions and collected a lot of data. Other times I really just use it as a source to collect people's stories. And to me, it's powerful to write a book that actually includes the direct quotes from people. Because so many times I read stories written by therapists in which they're describing a dialogue that they'd have with the patient. And in the back of your mind, you go, come on, that's not really what the patient said. But the cool thing about using the internet as a part of my research is that these are direct quotes. This is what that person said, because there it is in black and white or in pixels.
Yeah. Okay. And you do have those liberally sprinkled throughout your book. And they do give you that very direct sense of communication that you're talking about. Now, a lot of people, men in particular, would argue that maybe we're not wired to be monogamous, that we don't find a lot of examples in nature and so on. What about that?
I would say to those men, you're right. We don't know. I mean, we might be wired for monogamy. After all, 4 to 5% of mammals and vertebrates are wired for fidelity, do seem to have that as part of their instinct to be monogamous. But look, 95% aren't. And there are strong arguments why we may not necessarily be wired that way. That to me, that's immaterial, because as part of society, as part of a community, we need to make certain rules about how we function. As kind of higher level thinking beings, we can make decisions about how we're going to act. So there's a lot of things we're not wired to do. We're not wired to wear clothes. You know, we're not wired to go to work every morning at 8 o'clock and slog away till 5. And as a matter of fact, we're probably wired to punch out our neighbor when he plays his music too loud. But we don't do that, because being wired for something is different than what we're responsible for doing as competent adults. So there's so much to be gained from staying in a marriage and fostering health in that marriage and keeping that marriage going, that even if instincts would pull us away from it, both our moral obligation and our higher level intellectual functionings would tell us it's just not a good idea.
Well, let me pound away at it a little bit more. Other people will say, well, we used to live half as long as we live now, and maybe it's unrealistic to expect a marriage to last as long as, you know, we live these days.
It may be. It may be. And I know there are a lot of folks, you know, I'm a very pro-marriage author, a very pro-marriage therapist. And I do know that there are a lot of people that are in second marriages and are, you know, very happy with those marriages. And if we stick to the topic of infidelity, and I'd like to just kind of swing back to that. If you don't believe that you can stay in a happy marriage, if you believe that for some reason you need to go, you know, you've hit your right. So people only live till their mid 40s. So let's say you married at age 25. Now you're in your mid 40s, and you're saying, well, you know, according to David and according to other, you know, other statistics, I should never have lived this long. Now I'm going to look for somebody else. Well, I'm not sure I buy that. But even if it were the case, I would say you need to negotiate that with your spouse. You need to do, if necessary, divorce your spouse before you decide to seek relationships outside the marriage.
Okay. Let's not say according to David. I'm just posing some possible arguments that are out there. But, you know, speaking of David and David's experience, I know when I was coming up as a young man, and I'm a bit older than you are, the media and the culture don't seem to put out messages that are terribly supportive of either marriage or fidelity. The movie heroes were not guys who go out and mow the lawn every weekend and wash the car and stay close to home, nor were the heroes of all the novels that we read and the magazines that we read and so on. So I kind of wonder about our culture and what the impact of those messages are.
It's so funny that you mentioned that, because I just got done reading my second in a series of books. It's a, you know, kind of a thriller, detective, mystery books by this author named C.J. Box. And the protagonist is this guy named Joe Pickett. And he has a wife, and he has two daughters. And, you know, I'm a very pro-marriage guy. And every time the wife and daughter show up, I'm like, come on, get out of the picture so this guy can go off and solve his mysteries and, you know, do his manly thing.
Yeah.
It's like they annoy me. And yet here's an author that's really trying to humanize, his protagonist, his hero.
Yeah.
Who's out there with his guns solving problems in the ranges of Montana, et cetera. So, I get what you're saying, and I totally agree that we're given a message basically in our community and our society that you deserve the very best. And if for some reason your spouse is not meeting your needs, if you're not happy or if you've grown in different directions, that it's a reasonable thing to do just to end that marriage and acknowledge that each of you have grown in a different direction or you've made a mistake and move on. And I think that's a terrible message. That's certainly not, when people have had successful marriages, there have been lots of times in those marriages when they have felt like, they were not going to, that it was not going to make it. They didn't love the person anymore, but they stuck with it. And they realized that that was a phase they were going through. And so many marriages, when they get to that point these days, say, well, that's proof that we should end it. And they never really get to that point where they're able to look back and say, wow, we got through that, and I'm glad we did, because look how well we're doing now.
And yet we have these statistics do seem to be rather damning in terms of the frequency of infidelity. From your research and your experience, why do men cheat? Why do women cheat? Are they different reasons or pretty much the same?
There may be slight variations on a theme. I think some of it may have to do with what men are looking for in relationships and what women are looking for in relationships. And when they find that it's not... Part of the reason is that they find that what their needs are not being met in a relationship. They may start to look elsewhere. Woman I was interacting with as part of media opportunity, a television show, was a prostitute from the The Bunny Ranch, that was it. It was on the Playboy Channel or on Home Box Office. And she would tell me how some of her Johns would make appointments to come and meet with her, and they would really just want to sit there and talk with her about the days that they were, that they were the high school football quarterback. And they just, the idea that somebody would listen to their stories and really seem impressed by them, because that's part of their identity, and their wives just were basically giving them the message that they couldn't do anything right. So this might be an opportunity for someone to find somebody that makes him feel like he's special. And women will often feel like their husbands don't listen to them, that they're not getting in touch with their emotions. And so they'll go to their physical trainer who's touching them, who's talking with them, who's telling them how great they are and the successes they're making. And that'll be a real turn on. So part of it is what somebody's needs that aren't being met. But there are other parts that, of the equation that contribute to infidelity. So it's the acronym that I call NOD, which is need, opportunity, and disinhibition. Now, yes. We just talked for a second about the needs, and opportunities would be things like being at the gym, being at the workplace, even going to a high school reunion or a college reunion and slow dancing while you're after, you know, an hour or two after your spouse has gone home. All those are opportunities for infidelity. But even if you have the need and you have the opportunity, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about instinct. Do you act on your instinct, which is to jump into bed with that person or to madly send them text messages for the next 3 months until it evolves into an affair? Or do you suppress your impulses? You know, do you inhibit your impulses and prevent yourself from acting spontaneously? And that's the word disinhibition. People that aren't able to control their impulses are at higher risk for ending up in affairs.
Yeah, in fact, you point out that there's some overlap with certain psychological problems like ADHD, bipolar disorder, sociopathic disorder, substance abuse, that there's some relationship with infidelity. So maybe this is a good place to kind of touch on that.
Sure, and including people that have brain damage will often have problems inhibiting their impulses. Mm-hmm. I don't think that anybody that has an affair automatically has a medical illness or a psychiatric illness that can explain it, but that would be awfully neat and awfully convenient. What I'm saying is just part of the component of an affair is that disinhibition component. It may be worth taking a look at whether there is some underlying psychiatric problem. For instance, we know that people with attention deficit disorder tend to be more impulsive. They have more difficulty thinking through consequences. So they may act now and think later. Another example of that is somebody, if they're in a manic episode, if they have bipolar disorder, will very often end up doing things that have negative consequences. And that can often include excessive sexual behaviors, even with people outside the marriage. But I also don't want to leave out this issue of substance use and substance abuse, because it's probably the biggest contributor to people, particularly outside of the workplace, leading to getting involved in outside relationships they might not ordinarily have done. Just having a few drinks, meeting someone somewhere, and suddenly it seems like a good idea to go to bed with them.
Well, you've been doing this work, I gather, for maybe 30 or more years. Would I have that right?
Well, I've been, so my psychiatric practice began just short of 30 years. I've been a psychiatrist 28 years, or at least a medical doctor 28 years. And I've been married 25 years. Now, arguably, my research began the day after my wedding. As a matter of fact, part of the one of the stories I tell in my first book, The Secrets of Happily Married Men, is one of many errors I made as a married man that happened the first day of my honeymoon.
Well, that was your story. I remember coming across that story in this book, but I don't think you said who it was. I think you said it was a close friend.
Yeah, there was. Yes, there is a story in there of a very close friend, but the story I'm talking about is really more where I went to a volleyball game.
That's a different story.
Infidelity in that book. It simply talks about a man speaking his mind, and this is another honeymoon story, although it's not mine. Where he goes to the beach and sees this gorgeous woman and says, "Wow, she's beautiful." Not thinking that, you know, he's just being honest. And his wife was deeply offended on the honeymoon. But that would have been me. I mean, because what do you know? I mean, you're just married for the first time. You think it's okay to talk about whatever comes to your mind. But you do learn that you have to filter. And, And so unofficially, I started learning about marriage 25 years ago, but doing some more significant research probably about 20 years ago, and then began my writing and my website about 15 years ago.
Well, actually, I raised that issue as a preamble to just thinking about the changes that have been happening, both in terms of drug use, the ubiquity of drug use, and the ubiquity of technological tools that aid and abet.
That's
so,
right.
So that you've probably had to scramble a bit to keep up with all of these developments.
That is absolutely the case. When I look at, so I did a review of infidelity-related communications with me from when I first launched my website, which takes me from the year 2000 to the year 2002. And then I compared it to the last 2 years, so 2011 to 2013. Now, when I look back to the initial referrals to infidelity, of those samples, only 6% were specifically related to either the internet or electronics. So one person had met at like classmates.com, and another was on a social networking site. It wasn't even. It was like, I think it was a shared hobby site or something. The difference is that in the last 2 years, those rates have gone up to 65% of people either meet somebody on the internet or continue to have communication with them or communication through their cell phone text messaging as part of the package of infidelity. So it has hugely changed the game. But here's an interesting thing, David. It also has changed the game in terms of discovering infidelity. Because now, more than ever, people, I mean, you figure if General Petraeus, you know, the head of the CIA can be discovered for having internet, you know, communication with someone he's having a relationship with, most spouses can figure it out too.
Yeah. It's interesting that we've seen all these sort of high profile cases recently in the media. And it certainly brings all of this into focus. You know, one of the chapters that I particularly resonated to was the one in which you talk about hormones and neurotransmitters and their role and how the same inner biochemistry that drives us into marriage is also at play in possibly driving people into their affairs. And I love the way that you went through the biochemistry of it and in a really simple way, very clear. Maybe you can take us through a little bit of that.
Well, thanks for the positive feedback. What we understand about people when they become attracted to each other is that at the very first phases, it really is about estrogen and testosterone. So that there's almost a hormonal gut thing that will end up having two people in bed by the end of the night. And research shows that if a woman is in a certain phase of her menstrual cycle, she's much more likely to have sex with someone. She's much more likely to find someone sexually appealing, even though there's no cognitive, people aren't conscious that they're having those changes. There are changes. But what happens after that initial attraction is a shift. And that shift has to do with brain chemicals that are the same ones that are involved in addiction. And the three brain chemicals I talk about in the book are dopamine, which is a hormone, which is a arousal hormone. If you're watching ER or Grey's Anatomy and someone's in the emergency room and they're crashing and they have no blood pressure, they give them a dopamine bolus. They give them dopamine drip. It gets the blood pressure. It gets the blood circulating. So when you're having an affair, dopamine levels go up, and dopamine is also associated with addiction. So when you see a picture, if you're a cocaine addict and you walk into a room and there's a big bowl of cocaine in front of you, dopamine gets revved up in your system.
Mm-hmm.
The other chemical that gets revved up is norepinephrine, which is like, it's kind of like adrenaline. So these two chemicals are revved up when you're attracted to somebody, and they're chronically like pumping out the hormones and making you feel wonderful. In combination, there's one other hormone or one other brain chemical called serotonin, which is the calming brain chemical. It's the one that when we give people Prozac or Lexapro or Zoloft, it will make them calm. Well, this chemical actually is at a low level. And as a consequence, not only do you have this high level of arousal and drive of the norepinephrine and the dopamine, you also have this unsettled, obsessive behavior that is part of a low serotonin state. And this really drives, this is the biological engine that drives infatuation. Now, you alluded to earlier that it's actually normal if you're meeting somebody and falling in love and you're not already married or committed. I mean, you want this process to take place. You want it to take place in you. You want it to take place in the person that you're attracted to. And, you know, if all goes well, you can end up in marriage. But once you're married, you don't want those chain of events to happen with somebody else, because then it becomes problematic and even more likely, because of the secrecy component of it, to drive almost in the fashion of an addiction.
Yeah, but you may hunger to have that experience again, which probably leads into what you refer to as flame addiction.
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about flame addiction.
Well, flame addiction, once we understand some of the biological goings-on in our brain, we can see that when you meet somebody, become infatuated with them, you almost lose control. You often do lose control of rational thought, which is very similar to what we see in people who are experiencing addictions. So, it's like I call it flame addiction because, first off, it's an old-fashioned term, but I like it. A flame is someone that you're attracted to, a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You have a flame for somebody. It's an internal feeling that you have. And I like the analogy to the flame and the moth, the idea that this moth keeps circling around. Now, it's not good for the moth. Ultimately, the wings catch fire and it burns to death, but it cannot pull itself away. And that's what this flame addiction seems to feel like. Now, you make a good point, David, which is that people do hunger, they do thirst, they want this feeling to come back. But I really believe that there are ways of improving these feelings within your own marriage, of getting the dopamine levels higher, the norepinephrine levels higher, of starting to feel that attraction toward your spouse so you don't have to feel it toward the person in the cubicle across the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've spent a good deal of time talking about infidelity and what drives it, but the title of your book, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity, and in a way that may even come as a surprise to some listeners that it is survivable. I think a lot of people feel like, boy, if there's been infidelity, that's it. The marriage is over. The wife is calling the lawyer now. So let's talk about survivability and, what are the odds of survivability and what does it take to survive infidelity?
People do have that feeling, and often that feeling is one that they have in theory. So they'll say, if I ever find out my partner has cheated on me, then I would be out of here. But then, when the moment comes, they have to look at that and try to say, well, there are other issues mm-hmm. that may be at play here that I may not be able to sort out. It may not be as simple as leaving. And the other thing is that sometimes therapists will actually push people in that direction. So someone will go to see a therapist devastated over the affair that their partner had, and the response on the part of the therapist is, well, once a cheater, always a cheater. I've seen lots of these cases. You need to get out now.
And yeah, I actually read research years ago, and I don't know if it's still true, that most people who went to marriage counseling ended up getting divorced.
There was a pretty famous now study done by Consumer Report that showed of all the therapy types of therapy that people went to, that the least beneficial was couples therapy. On top of which, you're right, many do end up for divorce, although we have to remember that people often wait to go to therapy until they don't really feel that they have any other options. I pointed out earlier that I'm a big pro-marriage therapist, so you know, people come to me, and if they're if the person has committed multiple infidelities, continues to go back and reconnect with old flames or find new flames, I think that's a point at which staying in a marriage becomes dangerous. Or if there's domestic violence or substance abuse, I think can make marriage a place where it's no longer a place of safety. But I don't think that infidelity every time has to be an automatic ticket out of the marriage. It doesn't have to be one of the make it or break it points, although in theory it is for everybody. When push comes to shove, often people will say, all right, well, that was stupid of my partner to do, or that was irresponsible or ugly, but my partner's human. I've known them for the last 10, 15, 20 years. It doesn't surprise me they would do something like this under these circumstances. Help me figure out what to do next.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we have the example of Bill and Hillary Clinton. We don't know what's happening, you know, behind closed doors in their relationship. But evidently, there were factors there. There are factors there that made it make sense for them to stay together.
There's a lot of factors in people's lives, and not everybody lives under the microscope of Bill and Hillary or Anthony Weiner and his wife. But these factors may be similar for people. It may be a lifestyle choice issue. You know, if my partner, so let's take a typical American scenario where man is the main breadwinner, which is the case in 70% of American households. And let's say that he's having an affair. Well, the wife may say, look, you know, he's working on our marriage. He's committed to staying in the marriage. Do I have to divorce him? What would that mean about my quality of life? Or alternatively, it could mean, what would it mean to my children? I mean, their dad really messed up by having this affair, but he's been a good dad. Do I want to remove him from their lives? Other people, it's just their religion just says you don't get a divorce. Sometimes that can be very destructive because people can be in horribly unhealthy marriages, in unsafe marriages. But sometimes that they can hold on to that while they work through their marriage and end up feeling better at the end.
So what is the secret? It's the secrets of surviving infidelity. What are the secrets that people need to know in order to pass this trauma?
Yeah, sure. We covered some of them. I mean, one of the secrets is that your neighbor may be having an affair and you don't know it. So you're not the only person out there that struggle with something like this. And mm-hmm. so there's a good chance that other people have gotten through it and you don't know. The second part is that people can survive infidelity and that it doesn't have to mean it's the end of a relationship. And, you know, the other part is that, ironically, I think one of the best secrets for moving forward for an affair is to get rid of secrets. People have this idea that they'll figure it out, that or they'll go to a therapist and talk it out. But one of the things that I have found for people repeatedly who are able to work through marital difficulties is that there are rights and wrongs. There are things that you can do that can help you heal, and there are things that you can do that will mess it up. So I really give people a prescription for how to survive infidelity. The first step in that is to end the relationship with the person you're having an affair with. The next is to break off all communication with that person, which these days in the electronic world is not as easy to do as you'd think, but it is critical. And what I was just alluding to a few moments ago is that the third part of that is to keep no secrets. You have a transparent relationship, a see-through relationship in which emails, text messages, phone calls, snail mail, bank accounts, everything is shared by both partners.
Yeah, and you pretty dramatically, I think, go in that direction, prescribing that passwords be revealed for email accounts and other accounts so that the injured spouse has total access to all of the offender's, quote, private information.
Sure. And vice versa. I mean, both parties are now going to play by an open set of rules. And that's really the groundwork for redeveloping trust. And that's a big thing for people to swallow. It's a big thing for therapists to swallow, too. Often when I give talks, they'll say, well, hold on a second. People shouldn't people have the right to privacy? And my view is that people have the right to their private thoughts. And nobody's going to be able to have access to that. But I do think that the more you set barriers to privacy, more barriers to openness, the harder it is to develop trust.
Yeah, I've really come to see how important trust is. And I've actually been thinking about it in relation to attachment theory and, you know, that primary, I think in marital relationships, we're seeking almost the kind of unconditional love that ideally we would have received from a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very deep and very primitive. And so
yes.
When that gets violated, I mean, you can have all sorts of rationalizations about open marriage and, you know, rationalizations that you might think could override this very deep, very primitive, basic need for trust that once it's violated is really hard to rebuild. It's taken me a long time to understand it at that depth.
And it takes action on the part of the partners. It just can't be, let's will each other to trust. It has to have a degree of openness. And, you know, the flip side of that openness, though, David, is that it means that the person who is now receiving, has access to this information, also has to, they have to be responsible for their reaction to that. So, for instance, one couple that I treated, and this was a case in which the man did not have an affair, but the wife was very concerned about the fact that he would get emails from his, you know, high school or college buddies that occasionally would have lewd pictures in them or off-color jokes. And she was very offended about this. And I write about this in the in my book, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity. This was... So because she had access to this, she would punish him all the time for things that he really wasn't responsible for. And so if you're going to have this level of honesty, it also includes a certain degree of reserving judgment and not punishing your partner for everything that you find, particularly if it wasn't solicited.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. Well, there's a lot of talk these days about forgiveness, the importance of forgiveness and how it's poisonous if we don't let go of the resentments that we have and we don't forgive people. How does the injured spouse get to forgiveness in this scenario?
The first step to getting to forgiveness is for the person who has committed the offense to provide a sufficient degree of apology. So one of the things that happens often is the person who's caught having an affair reacts first of all with denial, then with accusations back toward the partner. Well, if you wouldn't have spied on me, You never would have found out about this affair, so how could you have betrayed my trust by spying on me? Ridiculous things. And eventually they move toward asking for forgiveness, but asking for forgiveness has to be done in a particular way, and that includes owning responsibility for not just having sex with somebody or IMing or texting somebody, but also for the lies that you've told, the betrayal of trust, or withdrawing resources from the family. So it really takes a bit of introspection on the part of the person who committed the affair, as well as being able to verbalize, these are the ways that I hurt you. And I am sorry for all of these. And even to the point where you can offer some type of restitution and begin this, what we talked about, ending the relationship, evolving the trust. So if you're asking about how to forgive, I think it's easy to forgive when you feel like the person has made a genuine apology and is moved toward helping to rebuild the relationship. Now, when it comes to the point of actually being able to say, okay, I forgive you, it's a leap of faith. You are right. It is poisonous to hold on to this resentment. It ends up destroying the person who's holding it. But the person that's holding it also doesn't want to feel like a chump. You know, they don't want to forgive just so that the partner can do it again. And right. And they may be holding out I want a little more from you. I want you to grovel some more. I want you to feel more shame. And those also aren't healthy. But I think at a certain point, and often that takes a while, somebody may say, look, I may not be able to trust my partner 100%, but I do understand and appreciate that they are genuinely remorseful about what they have done and have made efforts to move forward. The next step is to grant forgiveness, because that's an important step toward moving forward in the relationship.
I was struck by your mention of possibly offering restitution as part of the apology, but I'm not sure what restitution would look like.
Well, part of restitution is the complete honesty. So I was hiding everything. Now I'm going to be totally open. But one of the things I write about restitution is, I don't think there's any shame in saying, I'm terribly sorry. I have not spent time with you. I was spending time with the person in the office. I'm going to book a vacation, and you and I are going to spend time together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I'm going to put my resources and time out there, and we're going to do something for us. I'm going to make it up to you for what I did. Now, you can't obviously make up, if you cut off somebody's limb, you can't make it up to them. Their limb is gone. And I use that dramatic example because that's often how it feels for a person who's had an affair. But you can say, I will give you $1 million for your limb. That's what happens in the court system all the time. So the idea is that you make up for, to the extent that possible, what you've done and show that you're genuine about it.
We talked about couples therapy and the sometimes spotty track record of it before. Are there criteria that you would recommend as people go out to look for a couples therapist?
I do recommend certain criteria for looking for a couples therapist, and it's based on my experience. You, first of all, when it comes to infidelity, you want a therapist who is going to be able to focus on the infidelity specifically. So if you're there session after session after session and they're talking about your early childhood experiences and you're still trying to figure out what to do, you may have gone to the wrong person. You're going to want to ask that person whether they have experience treating couples, but everyone will tell you that they do. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't do you much good. So alternatively, you may ask how many times they've been married. And that may seem judgmental, or they may not be willing to share it. But if you want somebody that at least in their own life can use the tools to keep a marriage together, because anybody that has kept a marriage together knows it's really hard. So many of the famous people that have written about world-selling, huge best-selling books about relationships are in their second marriage. I wouldn't exclude that. But if someone's in their fourth or fifth marriage, you may want to take a look at that. If somebody says, I can't talk about my marriage, you know, that's not part of therapy, I don't want to see that person. I want you to see somebody that can say, you know, here are certain experiences that I've had, here are certain experiences that my patients have had, these are things that are helpful. You want somebody that's going to kind of give you an action plan, not just sit and listen and nod and then have you say, I'll see you next week. And the other thing is that you want someone who is able to say that they value your marriage, that it's not a matter of saying I value your happiness, because happiness comes in all kinds of shapes. But I value the fact that you chose to get married to this person, and that I'm not just going to assume that the easiest route for your happiness is to cleave off that part of your life. Because there's enough literature that shows us that while temporarily somebody will feel better after leaving their partner, it actually the long term does not lead to higher levels of happiness on average. So I think you want somebody that's going to be, at least if I were looking for a therapist, I would want somebody that's going to be that motivated to help your marriage instead of being neutral about it.
Okay, and certainly in your book you offer a lot of very concrete, you talk about action plan. You really offer concrete steps and concrete action plan. This is probably a good place for us to wind down. I'm wondering if there are any final thoughts that you want to get out to leave our listeners with.
I want to just punctuate what you said, which is that people often struggle when they first have an affair, and the impact is huge. And the problem is that the partner who's committed the affair often denies it, and so that it even causes more trust and more lies, and it's a terrible cycle. But I think it's worth people understanding and knowing that just because your partner has an affair does not mean he or she has some type of character flaw that can never be redeemed. Sometimes good people do wrong things, and good people have affairs. If you have the tools to work it through, to understand it, to understand why the affair happened, to know how to rebuild the trust, and then ultimately how to appropriately apologize and forgive, I think you can then get yourself back on track toward having a healthier marriage. Now, having a healthy marriage isn't easy in the first place, and even if you haven't had an affair. So don't lose hope, and remember that marriage is always a work, but the grass looks greener on the other side because someone's doing some good lawn watering and some good fertilizing. So if you do fertilize your own lawn and water your own lawn, you will find that you can have the marriage that you want.
That's a great metaphor. I like that. Dr. Scott Haltzman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you found this interview enlightening. This is a book which I think many could derive great benefit from. Dr. Haltzman is very out front about being pro-marriage. At the same time, he doesn't come across as judgmental. Rather, he comes across as level-headed and prudent. So whether you are struggling with the aftermath of one or more affairs, or are considering an affair, or just want to engage in a preventative conversation with your partner ahead of time, this would be a good book for you. If you're a young person who's not yet in a committed relationship, this would be a good book for you to read that might save you from a lot of pain and confusion down the road. Dr. Holtzman's writing style is eminently readable, very clear and down to earth, and not preachy at all. And for any couple desiring to recover from infidelity, he gives very specific advice with a lot more detail than we were able to get into here. You'll find the website he mentioned at www.drscott.com, and Dr. Scott is just D-R-S-C-O-T-T. And, as always, you're encouraged to order his book using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar. You will find that the paperback version is only $13.95 U.S., and the Kindle version $9.99. A small investment to potentially save a relationship.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Adam from Melbourne, Australia. I've been a long-time listener for over 7 years, and finally I think it's time to back up my appreciation of Shrink Wrap Radio with a donation. You provide such a wonderful, stimulating podcast, and you deserve to have this supported financially by your loyal listeners like me. And you're right, donating to Shrink Wrap Radio made me feel great. So I encourage other listeners to donate and keep supporting your unique podcast. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Thanks for this call to action, Adam, there in Melbourne, Australia. I want to thank all of you who have made donations, whether one-time or continuing. Your support really helps to keep me going. It's been some time since we've had a new donation, so maybe you're a relatively new listener and haven't done so yet. Another way of supporting Shrink Wrap Radio is volunteering to transcribe one or more interviews, and I'm happy to announce two new transcripts on the site, number 361, Deep Blues with Jungian analyst Mark Winburn, and I want to thank Gloria Ullman for that one, and number 265, The Polyvagal Theory with Stephen Porges, Ph.D., by Athena Papadakos. And I've been waiting a long time for somebody to transcribe that one. Somebody else made a start and gave up. So I'm really happy to have Athena step in and do that one. It's a really important theoretical contribution to the field, Dr. Porges' work, that is. Personally, I find these transcripts really helpful when reviewing past interviews, especially when I'm putting together CE courses. And I've heard from others who find them very useful to have a transcript. Well, it's an overcast Sunday morning as I'm working to get this latest one out, and I've got a book to read for a future interview and questions to generate for that one. Plus, my office is really crying out for its yearly deep cleaning. I hear layers of dust are not good for my electronic equipment, not to mention my allergies. And speaking of electronic equipment, I've got a bunch of computer issues I need to resolve. And I need to get out the next Shrink Wrap Radio newsletter. Am I complaining? Maybe. I'm feeling lethargic and resistant this morning. Maybe some of it is a hangover from a powerful film I saw last night with my son, Jonathan. The film was a winner at Sundance, and maybe we'll get some nominations at the Oscars. Although it's one of those small, independent films that's not getting very wide distribution. But if you get a chance to see it, I do recommend it. Maybe it will be available before long on Netflix. It's titled Fruitvale Station, and it's based on a true incident in which a young black man was shot and killed by a subway guard a few years ago in San Francisco's East Bay. The acting by the entire cast is incredibly good, which makes for a very powerful, though disturbing, story, and a deeply human one.
Hi, this is Dr. Marilyn Steele, Jungian psychotherapist and author of the 2013 book, The Wild Feminine, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Marilyn Steele. Yes, there is more Jungian content headed your way, and more about that in a bit. First, let's catch up on some back email from our listener community. Here's one from Australian listener Louise, and she writes, "Hey David, I'm happy to report that things have really shifted for me in my life, and your show has been a part of helping me through the transformation process. This week I landed a permanent job as a personal assistant, and the person I will be supporting is an academic who does research into organizational psychology and internal marketing. So hopefully we will have some common ground there, which helps when you work closely with someone. I plan to sign up for a regular donation to the show when the paychecks start rolling in." All right. Look forward to that. She goes on to say, "I've started some very successful therapy with a psychologist who works in a range of approaches, including the Pat Ogden somatic approach, narrative therapy, and Gestalt. We've been using a Gestalt approach to work on my disorganized attachment issues, which I feel are at the heart of my emotional issues. The change in me has been astounding! Exclamation point. I've also had my ADHD diagnoses confirmed by a psychiatrist who has specialized in that area for over 30 years. In a few weeks, I will start on Ritalin, as well as the other cognitive work I've been doing with a brain gym specialist. Just three therapists now, and it's all working well, I think. I am relieved to have the Ritalin starting just before my new job, because being a personal assistant would have to be one of the craziest jobs for someone with ADHD. You are essentially acting as an extension of that person's prefrontal cortex. I do have the skills in it, using technology to make many time, task, and correspondence management more streamlined and self-organized, but getting there for someone else can be a big task. Having some clinical help with my focus should be a big help. Anyway, I loved your show about creativity, and I will be checking him out further. It is so exciting to hear so many of my own experiences reflected in someone else's voice and from such a delightful and informed perspective. I just keep thinking, yes, 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 as I was listening. So, good work once again. Big creative hugs, Louise. Louise, thank you so much for that. It's always good to hear from you. I'm glad to hear that the many therapists that you're working with are moving you along and that you've got this great new job. And you're so bright and so creative that I'm sure it's going to be a big asset for the person that you're working with. So thanks for keeping me updated on your life. It's always good to hear from you. Next, we hear from Doreen, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. While I'm admittedly not one of your biggest contributors, I am one of your biggest fans, and I do my monthly part and hope to offer more in the coming months. Have you ever considered interviewing Stephen C. Hayes, PhD, on his extraordinary work on acceptance and commitment therapy? I'm taking a master class with mentor coach by Joseph Giarocci, I think that's how you would say it, PhD on mindfulness, acceptance, and positive psychology, The Seven Foundations of Well-Being. It's a 2013 book authored by Joe Giarocci and Todd Kashdan, PhD. They would be equally engaging and authoritative on the subject of ACT therapy. Thank you for your continued contributions and the breadth of knowledge you offer. I am ever so grateful for each and every recording and the inspiration and education that they avail. Embrace the present moment, Doreen." And thank you so much for that, Doreen, and for your contributions. And in fact, I have interviewed Stephen Hayes. He's one of my very first interviews on my Wise Counsel podcast series. So if somebody wants to hear that, they should go to wisecounselpodcast.com and look in the archives, and you'll find that interview. In addition, I would recommend that you listen to my interview number 272 with Australian author Russ Harris on the Happiness Trap, which is his version of ACT therapy. And thanks so much for the two authors who you suggested that I interview. I will add them to my long and growing list. Here's another email from listener and champion transcriber Renata Silecki, who writes, "Hi, David. I knew people were requesting Gabor Mate, and I was going to put a vote in for that last time I emailed. I listened to your commentary at the end about feeling intimidated by him and not quite getting to his most current work. He seems to live humanist psychological ideals in his work in a very real way. I think a lot of what he brings to his work is a very thoughtful, very thorough, and on-the-ground analysis of some real hot-point issues in mental health and the mind-body question. And I think it's a sign of your talent as an interviewer that you provide a forum for people to be able to talk about their insights in an in-depth way. So that was what I was picking up on in the interview. I didn't find that it was a particular deficit of the interview that you spent a lot of time talking about his views on addiction, which aren't part of his most current work. He's got a very humane and realistic framework for his ideas, and I think that listeners outside of Canada may not be familiar with his work. The types of issues that you touched on are common ones that don't frequently get enough airtime, especially in terms of fresh viewpoints. So while the newest insights were interesting, and I definitely like to hear more about the experimental treatments, I still found it to be an insightful interview, and I think it was a good introduction to his work. I know he's busy, but maybe if you offered him a follow-up interview to talk about his more current work. And that's from Renata. And Renata, after our interview was over, he did suggest that he would be open to a follow-up interview somewhere down the line on his earlier books. Not so much on his current work, but on his earlier books. I think right now he's going into a kind of a sabbatical break, if you will, kind of refocusing to work on another book. That was the impression that I got. So I do hope to talk to him again down the line, and thank you for all your transcription work and for your support. And finally, here's one more, this one from Joseph, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a new follower and fan of Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel and would like to say that I love the shows. I'm also a fourth-year Psy-D student in the Bay Area, so hearing the experts has given me a lot of helpful information to aid my own clinical work and personal transformation. I'm sure you get many requests to have certain professionals on, but I'd like to add to the list. I recently had the pleasure of meeting an amazing psychotherapist, Harry Aponte, and would like to request that you have him on your show. He's been featured in APA videos for his work in structural family therapy, which is how I learned of his work, and has a great history with many of the big names in family therapy. Here is a link to his website where you can find his publications, workshops, and some of his history. And the website that he gives here is www.harryjaponte.com. Specifically, I would like to hear him talk about his idea of the person of the therapist, which is found on his website under workshops. With this idea, he discusses mastering both restraint in the therapy room as well as bringing your genuine true self into the room. I only had a brief amount of time to speak to him about it, and as a student of clinical psychology, I think it would be extremely beneficial to learn more. To be honest, I learned just as much from his presence as I did from what he had to say. Each bit was golden." And then he gives a link to a YouTube clip, which I think you can find on your own. So Joseph concludes, "Thank you so much, Dr. Dave, for your amazing efforts to connect the people within our profession. Warmly, Joseph." Joseph, thank you so much for taking time to write and letting me know that you're out there and that as a student you're finding this work to be valuable. And I really appreciate your suggestion, and I'm very likely to follow up on it because I think I'm in the midst of maybe putting together a little CE course on family therapy. And so it sounds like he would be a good addition. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. My message machine is so lonely. It's been a while since anybody's left a message there. Thanks to Dr. Scott Haltzman again for sharing his expertise and wisdom on the very challenging tasks posed by surviving infidelity. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Marilyn Steele, a Jungian psychotherapist, and we'll be discussing her delightful book on the wild feminine, which should have appeal to both women and men. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.